other college career. So the main reason to study philosophy is that you find intrinsic value in reflection and contemplation. I just love that quote. So one of our goals is the Dallas Philosopher's Forum is to encourage this reflection and contemplation leading to an enriched life. We are a not-for-profit organization dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson with the Dallas Philosopher's Forum. I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So, do we have any first-time visitors? Oh, we have some. So, sir, can you tell us your name and how you found out about us?
Don Llewellyn. I guess I found out about it through Justin.
Oh, okay. So you're one of Justin's compadres?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you in academia as well?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you teach?
I don't teach anything now. I was actually a consultant, but when I retired, I didn't teach.
Oh, okay. Philosophy?
No, actually it was computer science.
Okay, fantastic. There's a lot of similarities, computer science and philosophy, right? A lot of logic.
They've been doing a lot of philosophy since then, though. Justin was leading a philosophy club. We went about 6 years. We went through college level tests there.
Oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic. Yes, sir?
My name is Mark Hublin. I figured this out on meetup.com.
Okay.
And, seemed like an amazing opportunity. So
wonderful. Welcome. And then, yes, sir. Yes. What's your name? Yeah.
Art Cooper. I was an engineer, but I do find philosophy interesting.
Okay. Welcome, man. How did you find out about us?
Spell
okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. And then we have a young student back there. What's your name?
Hi. I'm Katie. I'm a high school student, and I found out about it by looking at Dallas Philosophy.
Okay, and you're taking a philosophy course in high school now, right?
Yeah, it's a program through Northlake.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm taking one of the classes there.
And so what is it about philosophy that attracted you?
I've never really seen a lot of people studying it before, that I know that there are people interested in studying it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really know much about it, and so I was just looking through all the humanities courses on and I saw it, and I was like, oh, that might be interesting. Take this learn something new, and I become really interested in all the material and stuff. And it's
oh,
really eye-opening to see like all the stuff.
All philosophers are very intelligent and very good looking as well. So. And then did you bring your dad with you? Did you bring your father with you?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Welcome, sir. Anybody else new to the? Okay, great. So if you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Several of us got in before David Drum, our treasurer. David, raise your hand. So if you haven't paid, then please pay the $5 after the lecture is complete.
And for students?
And for students, it's $2, but she already paid. So she's on top of things. I also want to remind everyone to take your meal or drinks before you leave in front of the restaurant. Sometimes people will forget, inadvertently forget, and we have to pick up the tab, and philosophy is not free. And also please be generous with your wait staff. The restaurant is kind enough to provide us this room for free. In addition, we have a website that Ken Sauter, our illustrious treasurer, not treasurer, you're our AV guy, has a lot of that same information. Ken's responsible for all of our AV and keeping our website up to date. He does a fantastic job with that. And then if you like this lecture, please feel free to forward the information on to your friends and family. You can also sign for updates on meetings at www.meetup.com, Dallas Philosopher's Forum, /members. So tonight our speaker will present for about 45 minutes or so, and then we open up for questions, and a lot of participants find that that's one of the more enjoyable parts of the evening. So with the questions, we're looking for a short statement or two, and then getting to the question. One last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on a vibrate mode at this time. We're very privileged to have Dr. Justin Fisher with us tonight. Dr. Fisher is an assistant professor of philosophy at SMU. He earned his BS with honors in mathematics, philosophy, computer science, and political science. Now that's pretty impressive. And even more impressive is that he got that from the University of Nebraska, my school. Go Nebraska, go Big Red. He later earned an MA in philosophy from the University of Connecticut and his PhD in philosophy from the University of Arizona. His area of expertise includes philosophy of mind and cognitive science, philosophy of science, especially biology, metaphysics, epistemology, and decision theory. And he's a real Renaissance man. We're so lucky to have him tonight because we look through his vita and it's amazing the breadth and depth of his interests and his areas of expertise. Dr. Fisher will be speaking tonight about who should be allowed to vote. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Justin Fisher.
Let's see if I'm right here and you all can hear me.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you all for having me here. This is a fairly personal topic for me, as you'll see, and wasn't actually on the list of specializations he gave, but I thank you for humoring me and listening to me rant a little bit about the poor experience I had in the past. So it's election season, and you got a lot of all the stuff that's going on now, all the talking heads on TV, and the yard signs up, and the blowhard pundits prognosticating who's going to win, and all the campaign commercials and everything like that. And so it kind of warms the heart, maybe for lots of you, but for me, it brings about this deep feeling of resentment. Back in 1992, there was a big presidential campaign going on. I'll age myself here. This is my first year of college. So I was a very engaged college student on top of all the political process. I knew more about our political system than almost anybody did. And really, really wanted to vote, but I was not allowed to vote. I really resented it. Now, why wasn't I allowed to vote? Was I a convicted criminal? No, I haven't been convicted yet. Was I a Kenyan-born Muslim terrorist? Nope, that wasn't the problem. The problem was, in 1992, I was 17 years old, and 17-year-olds are not allowed to vote. And I really resented that fact. So tonight, I'm going to be sort of ranting about why I wasn't allowed to vote, considering what the reasons might be for preventing 17-year-olds from voting, and what reasons there might be for letting some people vote and not letting other people vote. And considering whether or not those reasons really would support having prohibited me from voting back when I wanted to vote. This turns out to be a pretty old debate. There are two main reasons that I'll consider that might justify setting particular boundary lines over who is allowed to vote, who's not allowed to vote. You can see the two camps in this debate were present among our founding fathers. So we have here Federalists like Jefferson, Adams, and Madison, and Anti-Federalists. I didn't do that right, did I? Jefferson and Franklin over here on the Anti-Federalist side. And so a lot of the reasons we see for justifying different ways of saying who should be allowed to vote were already present in the debate here, where we have the Federalists who thought that there should be a very restricted right to vote, that not too many people should be allowed to vote. Their view was that basically it ought to be just white people, just men, and not just any white men should be allowed to vote. It should be further restricted than that, where it's basically white property owners should be allowed to vote. So have a fun quote from Adams here. He says, well, the same reasoning which will induce you to admit that all men who have no property to vote would also prove that you ought to admit women and children to vote, which you might think, oh, that's a very progressive argument about extending the franchise to women and children, but no, Adams took this instead to be a reductio, saying, well, that would be horrible if we let women and children vote. It's dangerous to open so fruitful a source of controversy and altercation, so we should just restrict the vote to white male property owners, was his view. On the other side, here's a fun quote from Ben Franklin, an anti-federalist, who thought that we should have a much more expansive a right to vote should just restrict it to property owners, so he gives this argument. Today, a man owns a jackass, I guess is a donkey, worth $50, and he is entitled to vote. But before the next election, the jackass dies. Now, gentlemen, pray inform me, in whom is the right of suffrage? In the man or in the jackass? Good. So we can see the boundary lines here. What we're going to do in this talk is, first of all, think about a way of justifying how voting boundaries should be drawn in sort of the way that the Federalists were thinking about it. And then we'll ask whether or not that way of justifying drawing the boundaries really should have excluded me from voting back when I was 17. And then similarly, we'll think about a more anti-Federalist way of justifying how we should draw the boundary lines, and then consider whether that way of justifying the boundary lines should have prohibited me. So who won? The Federalists or the Anti-Federalists? I guess one way of doing this is just to add up the currency that they ended up on, and so I guess the Federalists have a cure thanks to Madison being on the $5,000 bill. Not that anybody ever uses those, and all we have are the Ben Franklin's $100 bills. So. But the Constitution itself was much more of a compromise between these views, where the House of Representatives had a popular election with, well, wasn't everybody allowed to vote, of course. It was just white males, but they ended up not even having an explicit property requirement, though state legislatures had some leeway in the Constitution to be able to put property requirements. Whereas the Senate, at least the way the Constitution originally put it, before amendment, was that the senators would be appointed by state legislatures, and the Federalists were hoping that this would end up having basically be appointed by rich white males to preserve the interests of rich white males. So the Federalists won in lots of ways in the Constitution, but the two centuries since then have been largely step after step in the anti-federalist direction, expanding the right to vote. So the right to vote after the Civil War was extended to black men in addition to white men. Early in the last century, it was extended to women as well. In the last century, it was extended to 18-year-olds. Before that, you had to be 21 to vote. Also, a constitutional amendment made the Senate now be senators be elected by popular vote in the states rather than being appointed by state legislatures. And there also have been various findings that have helped expand the right to vote for, by removing things like poll taxes that have prohibited some sort of people from voting. So in the years since the Constitution was adopted, we've had a shift more or less in the anti-federalist direction, opening up the right to vote to more and more people, though not yet to people under the age of 18. So despite all these steps in what I think is the right direction, they hadn't quite stepped far enough to let me vote when I really cared about it. And so we'll focus mostly today on questions about whether young people should be allowed to vote, partly just because that's a deeply personal issue for me, but also partly because that's the largest group of people that's outright disallowed from voting now. There are lots of other people who have various obstacles, either some people who also are outright disallowed from voting, and lots of other people who face various obstacles involving the time and expense that's involved in voting or in getting the various paperwork done that you need to get done in order to vote. And I'm happy to talk about some of those things in the discussion period. But for the talk, I'm going to focus mostly on this personal issue for me about whether or not young people should be allowed to vote. Okay. So why deny the right to vote to young people? Here are some quotes from New Hampshire representatives in New Hampshire. Gregory Sword here says, college students have a dearth of experience, a plethora of the easy self-confidence that only ignorance and inexperience can produce. And then the New Hampshire speaker, Bill O'Brien, said they don't have life experience and just vote their feelings. So, and here, I think that wasn't even people younger than 18 they were trying to disenfranchise. It was people who were college students in New Hampshire, but still the same sorts of reasoning could easily be mustered against letting even younger people than most college students are, keeping them from voting. So they have these worries about self-confidence, ignorance, inexperience, voting their feelings.
And you might worry, yeah,
well, a lot of kids, that does describe them, and so maybe that's a reason to keep them from voting, but that doesn't just describe lots of kids, it also describes lots of adults. So here we can have this sort of idealized picture, which is, I think, what the Federalists had in mind of the sort of ideal voter that is really thoughtful, well-informed, and is going to make really good choices. Just letting anybody who's over the age of 18 vote isn't always going to get you this. So here we have one of the protesters back when Obamacare was originally being voted on, saying, get a brain, morons, whatever that is. Probably he had an overabundance of self-confidence, probably a fair dose of ignorance. I'm not sure about his experience, but it's not looking too good. And similarly, about voting his feelings, one suspects that he might be doing that a bit too much. So. But he probably is, at least it looks like he's over the age of 18. So it seems like if our understanding of who ought to vote is motivated by trying to keep people with those features from voting, we could do a better job of that than just drawing a boundary line at age 18 and prohibiting them. There might be other ways that we could try to figure out who has the relevant experience, who has the relevant understanding of what's going on. So that way we could try to make sure that we just got these ideal voters voting and not all the people with all these bad traits voting instead. Here's some evidence of how adults aren't necessarily all that well-informed and they're voting in ways that, at least if you have this ideal of a well-informed voter in mind, the way that the Federalists did, would make you worry that, our population isn't really meeting that ideal. So shortly before the 2004 election, so remember this is the election pretty soon after Bush had taken the country to war against Iraq on the pretense that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So this was polling shortly before that election. 72% of Bush's supporters said that we had found WMDs in Iraq. It was well known at that point that no, we haven't found them. 58% of them said that if we'd known there weren't WMDs, we shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq, which would make a big difference to who you ought to be supporting in this election. So putting that together, it seems like lots of people who supported Bush in that election, had they been better informed, shouldn't have had at least unequivocal support for Bush in that election. More recent polling, only 52% of Americans know that Obamacare hasn't been repealed since Republicans took over all the branches of government since then. 22% of Americans think that it actually has been repealed already. Healthcare is one of the top issues for lots of Americans in the election. Not even knowing what the current law is pretty big impediment to being able to make this sort of ideal, rational, well-informed vote. If you poll Americans about how much the federal government spends on various different things, the median result is that people think that 5% of the federal budget goes to public broadcasting, things like NPR, and 10% of the budget goes to foreign aid. Most of these numbers are tremendously much too high. It's a tiny fraction. Here's a cartoon back when Mitt Romney was running and trying to cut funding from NPR to balance the budget. So we have 8 kids, just 6 hours of spending on defense equals the entire federal subsidy for public television. Mitt Romney thinks he can balance the budget by defunding us. Mitt needs to learn how to count. Good. They're just pointing out that how deeply far off these estimates were, and yet people are voting with the thought that they're somehow going to be balancing the budget by cutting things that are just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what the budget actually is. Good. So you might think, well, what we need to do is the way we're going to justify drawing boundaries around who's allowed to vote is make sure that we can get people who know the right answers to a lot of these questions, have some sort of civics literacy test to get make sure that people can agree on basic facts that all the parties really agree to in these debates, and keep the people who are completely misinformed about this stuff out of the process because they're likely just going to be noise that messes it up. Now, there is a very checkered, unfortunate history about literacy tests in America. That a lot of Jim Crow laws involved literacy tests that were more or less, maybe not quite explicitly, but was not very thinly veiled, that really the point of these tests was to disenfranchise black voters, to keep black people from voting. And there were some obvious problems with these tests. So, one problem was that they were discriminatorily applied, that the white people who were running the polling places got to decide who had to take a literacy test, and they let white people out of taking the test. It would only apply the test to black people. There were also tremendously irrelevant questions that had nothing to do with the current issues of the day. So, for example, here's a question from a literacy test that people had to pass, and black people had to pass in Georgia in 1958 to be allowed to vote. Who is the Solicitor General of the state judicial circuit in which you live, and who is the judge of such circuit? If such circuit has more than one judge, name them all. Can anybody do that?
No.
No. So is it fair to just ask black people to answer that question before they get to vote, but let white people in for free? You know, obviously this is just a discriminatory system that isn't a good way of trying to make sure that you're only going to have well-informed, ideal voters be your voters. Here's another test from Alabama, 1965. In what year did the Congress gain the right to prohibit migration of persons to the states? Again, what does that have to do with politics in 1965? Why should we worry about whether people are well-informed about that? So, you might think, okay, that just tells us we shouldn't have any sort of literacy test as a requirement for voting. But I'm not sure. I mean, what this definitely shows us is that it's a problem. That there are bad ways of doing this. There are ways that you shouldn't do a literacy test. And this is very clear examples of bad ways of doing a literacy test. But we effectively do have another sort of literacy test that if anybody wants to drive, which I bet lots of you drove here tonight, in order to drive here, you had to take a sort of driving literacy test. You took the state driver's test in order to be allowed to drive a car, and you know, maybe this is controversial, I hope it isn't. I think it's a good thing that people have to pass a driving test before they drive cars, because driving cars can cause really grievous harm to other people, and I like it that everybody out on the road needed to pass a driving test before they were out on the road. And I guess why is the driving test good, whereas these Jim Crow literacy tests weren't? Well, one of the differences is the driving test isn't discriminatorily applied. It's mandatory. Everybody needs to pass the driving test before they're allowed to drive. So it isn't that we just do it to one race and let other races drive for free. Another big difference is the questions on the driving test are relevant. They have to do with the actual things that come up for drivers. And so it isn't just your relevant gotcha questions that are intended to disenfranchise people from driving. Instead, they're really relevant questions that make a difference to driving. So, to me at least, the existence of tests like the driving test show that there can be a sort of literacy test that isn't horribly discriminatory and is a fine way of going about things. And so, seems like if you think that the ideal national well-informed voter is the way that you want to justify drawing your boundary lines for who you're going to allow to vote, then you shouldn't just let any 18-year-old plus vote. You should have them do some sort of test to make sure that they're at least minimally well-informed about issues that all the parties agree what the facts of the matter are, and exclude the other ones. And then basically it's the same reason that you want drivers to be well-informed, because you can cause harm if you vote for a candidate based on your misinformation, as is suggested by also making people take a civics literacy test before they end up voting. So there are at least two ways you could construe this sort of policy change. One just is this is a way that people who otherwise wouldn't have been allowed to vote, so kids under the age of 18, maybe passing a test like this would show, hey, they ought to be allowed to vote because, look, they are well-informed about material. So you could just have this be an extra way that somebody is allowed to vote in addition to managing this right for 18 years, you can do that, or you can take this test, and so just be extending the franchise to young people who can pass the test. But you might also think that this should be used in an exclusionary fashion. Make the adults pass this test, and if they can't, then exclude them from having the right to vote. And it seems like this sort of conception that the Federalists had is that elections supposed to be determined by these ideal well-informed voters would justify having both of these, both allowing some people to opt in by passing the test, but also excluding others who couldn't pass the test. But at least for my very narrow personal interests, I would have passed whatever the test was, I would have passed it when I was 17, so at least on this conception of who should be allowed to vote, it's pretty clear, I think I should have been allowed to vote when I was 17. So how would this affect the sort of partisan tug of war that there is in our country between Republicans and Democrats? There are people like Tom Tancredo, who was a representative in the U.S. House and one of the presidential candidates on the Republican side in one of the recent primaries. He basically attributed Obama's election to the absence of a literacy test. He thought if only there had been a literacy test in place, then Obama wouldn't have gotten elected. So his view, at least, was that having a literacy test would pull the tug of war in the Republican direction. On the flip side, there were studies that were done back when Jon Stewart was with us at Daily Show. I haven't looked at recent studies with Trevor Noah as the host, but back then, polling people, or actually giving people tests about current affairs, and asking them where they got most of their news from, Daily Show viewers, who tend primarily to be Democratic, were the top performing group on this test. People who watched the Daily Show were more up on current events than basically people who watch any of the other things, and the bottom performers were people who watched Fox News, if that was their primary source of news. And other studies have shown that the more you watch Fox News, the less well-informed you end up being about issues. So those sorts of studies suggest that a literacy test might actually pull in the direction of Democrats. Not sure which way this would go, and maybe it's partly an empirical question, but it's not even clear that it does pull most strongly one way rather than the other in our current partisan divide. Let's shift gears a little bit and think about what the distribution of voters is in our country. So my graph here, the people, it's arranged by age, so we have over at the left the people who are 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and so on. In these columns, so my two kids, since they're under 5, are over here not voting at all, because they aren't even allowed to vote. And up here we have people who are 85 plus. And so you can see a couple of things on this graph. I guess one obvious thing is people under the age of 15 are outright disallowed from voting. And even after people are allowed to vote, the rates of voting are pretty low up until you get to around age 50, and then retirees vote a lot more than any other people in our population do. So definitely the way that these elections are going is the outcomes determined by a non-random sampling of our population. It's heavily biased towards people who are older. And part of this is because younger people are explicitly disenfranchised, and part of it's due just to differences in voting behavior. Probably a lot of it has to do with how busy people are, how much time people have available to do stuff. I think we're going to do questions at the end.
I just want to ask, is that number of people representing to the population?
It's a number of people, I think. So we were seeing that basically the population of really old people is smaller than the population of younger people, and so that's why the total height is dropping. Good. So and that there is just a getting time and money that it costs to vote. Good. So another way that you might justify thinking about who should be allowed to vote is to say, well, if what we want to do is sample a whole bunch of people and enact policies that either are serving the interests of our citizenry or at least policies that are good policies by whatever metric, then you might think, well, it's just good to get a big sampling of a whole bunch of different people. There's this theorem called the Condorcet Curie theorem that basically shows if you have a bunch of people, each of whom is better than a coin flip at determining what the right policy is, and they're independent of each other, then the probability that their majority will go in the right direction is very high, even if it's just 12 jurors, but especially if you have 100 million jurors all voting, if they each are better the chance at getting the right answer, then it's tremendously likely that their majority will give you the right answer. So this way of thinking about things suggests, well, really what we ought to do is extend the right to vote to anybody who's better than chance at being correlated with whatever the right policy decision is, and especially if we think the right policy decisions have to do with promoting the interests of our population in general, then sampling the entirety of the population rather than just getting this very biased, skewed sampling of a portion of our population would be the way to go. So this sort of reasoning weighs much more in the direction of saying we ought to extend the right to vote as broadly as we can. So putting this reasoning together, instead of the teacher saying voting is for old people, it should be voting is for all people. And here, I guess this is kind of reiterating Adam's reasoning that we mentioned at the beginning of the talk, where Adams was saying, well, if you extend the right to vote to poor white men, then you'll also need to extend it to women and children. Well, this sort of line of reasoning says, yeah, maybe that's right. We should extend the right to vote to women. Hopefully that's uncontroversial now, but also to children, which is a bit more controversial. How would we do that? I guess one simple way of doing that is just lowering the voting age. Instead of having 18-year voting age, maybe it should be 16 or 12 or something like that. That would be allowing a lot more kids to vote, and kids definitely have interests in what the outcomes are going to be, in lots of cases more interests because they're going to be alive for a lot longer than a lot of the people who currently do vote are going to be, and so they'll be affected for a longer period of time by the policy decisions. Kids pay taxes too. Kids that are 16 or older are working and have payroll taxes removed from their thing, so they're having taxation without representation, which is one of the big motivations for the American Revolution, so that's a strong motivation for at least reducing the voting age to 16. Kids end up buying lots of other stuff, or at least having lots of other stuff bought for them, so sales tax are paid on lots of things for kids. So again, we're having taxation for that representation for lots of stuff that goes to kids much younger than 16. So this is suggesting that maybe the voting age ought to be a lot lower than it currently is. Maybe what we ought to do is extend the right to vote to anybody who can vote. So if my 4-year-old wants to go in and vote, then maybe we should let him go in and vote. He has an interest in the outcome. He's better than chance, because I'll help him, getting the right outcome. And if we're just trying to get an outcome in the election that's correlated with what the thing that's going to help our population is going to do, when we shouldn't overlook my 4-year-old, because he's a member of our population and he has interests and he's going to be affected a lot more than a lot of other people are by the policies that we make, so why not take his interests? Another sort of version of this policy would be for even kids who, I'm not sure my 3-year-old, I think maybe she would even get it already, but maybe she's not quite old enough to vote yet. She just turned 3. So maybe she would be able to figure it out on her own. Paul DeMenny, who's a demographer, has advocated this sort of voting scheme, suggests that, well, for kids who can't vote on their own, maybe we should give parents a sort of proxy vote on the kids' behalf. And so the way DeMenny suggests doing this is have the two parents of a kid each get a half vote. And so if the parents agree with each other as to what the kid's vote ought to be, then that gets a full vote, whereas if the parents disagree, then I guess that their votes kind of cancel each other out on the kid's behalf. But still, this lets everybody in our population end up being represented, either themselves if they can do it, or by a proxy if they can't do it themselves. Not sure which way I would lean. I'm definitely, I guess, I think I'm willing to go to 2, I think, and I'm not so sure about 3. I have misgivings about that. We can talk about it in the discussion, where I'm not totally on board with 3, but I also think maybe it would be a good idea. So we can talk about what exactly we think about that. How would this sort of thing affect the partisan government? If we have a bunch of kids involved now. Here it seems to me like it's not clearly one side or the other. There are lots of traditional issues that Republicans have talked a lot about, so things like deficit spending. The deficit spending we do now, it's going to be the next generation that ends up really facing the bills when they come due, there's going to be lots of ways in which if children are involved in these processes, they might be more reluctant to put things on the nation's credit card than older people, especially people we don't expect to be alive when the bills suddenly come due, are going to be. So that might shift in the traditional Republican direction against deficit spending. Well, at least they say they're against deficit spending. It doesn't seem clear, but they actually mean it when they say it. Still, it seems like this is a traditional Republican issue that kids probably are going to be pulling in the traditional Republican direction. But other things like, the impact of climate change, that's something that a lot of older voters aren't going to be around long enough for it to really make much difference to their lives, but lots of kids are going to be around where it really is going to make a difference to those lives. And so this is traditionally a Democrat issue that it seems like getting kids involved might pull in the direction of them. So other issues that are similar to this, family values, I'm not sure quite what that means, but kids are definitely in families in ways that lots of grown-ups without kids aren't, and so it might pull in the direction of some family values issues that are traditionally a Republican talking point. Issues about funding of education, kids will definitely have an interest in making sure their schools are well-funded in a way that not all adults are. Other issues like gay marriage, there's very strong generational divides on support for various gay rights issues that young people are much more in favor of, don't see what the big deal is, whereas the people who do most of the voting now are much more opposed to this. And so this is something where getting more people who are younger involved in these sorts of issues is going to probably shift what the balance is in the outcomes of elections. So to me, this looks like it's not a clear victory for either side over the other, so potentially there could be bipartisan support for including kids in these processes. Okay, so let's go back and do a sort of summary. I've talked about 2 different ways that you might justify drawing boundaries around who's allowed to vote and who's disallowed from voting. So one way was this sort of Federalist conception of the ideal voter who's rational and well-informed, not swayed by emotions and ignorance and overconfidence and all that stuff. And if that's what we're using to justify drawing boundaries around who we're going to allow to vote, then it seems like using 18 years old as your cutoff is a really crude way of determining who these rational and well-informed voters are going to be, and we could do much better using something like the driving test that we have to draw boundary lines around who we're going to allow to drive on the roads. So if we could use some sort of civics literacy test, that would do a much better job at making sure our voters met this ideal image of what voters ought to be. For my own personal interests, this would have the nice effect that smart 17-year-olds would have been allowed to vote, so I would have had a pathway by which I could have voted back in 1992. But it does raise questions about whether all the adults that we currently allow to vote, whether we should be allowing them to vote. Maybe they still have a pathway to vote. They could be well informed about the issues if they wanted to and wanted to vote. But maybe if they are opting to get well informed about the issues, maybe the upshot of this reasoning is that we shouldn't be letting as many ill-informed adults vote as we currently do. We also talked about this other, more anti-federalist, extend the right to vote to anybody who has an interest in the process, who's somewhat correlated with what the right outcome is going to be, and count on the law of large numbers and Congress's jury theorem to ensure that, with very high probability, that process will produce the right outcome. This sort of reasoning suggests that we ought to extend the right to vote to lots of people, and that would include kids, not even just the smart kids, but any kids might be ones who ought to be involved in this process. But it raises issues about, well, what about the really little kids who aren't really capable of voting on their own? Should we have some sort of proxy voting or something like that to allow them to vote as well? So for the purposes of this talk, I'm not going to commit myself as to which of these conceptions of how to draw the boundary line is the right way to go. I'm happy to talk about that in discussion. The key point I was trying to make, again, very selfishly, is that whichever of these conceptions you think is the right way of drawing the boundary lines up around who ought to be allowed to vote, I should have been allowed to vote in 1992. So take that, 1992. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, so open it up to questions, and please keep your statements fairly brief, and then get to your question.
So it seems like there's an important question that was unremarked on this presentation, and that is, what is the purpose of voting? And you just made a brief statement. I noticed there are two. When I talk to people, there tend to be kind of two schools that people fall into. One is that voting is a signifier of dignity or respect that society is, extending some signifier of dignity to a group by wanting to vote. And the other is that the purpose of voting is sort of a mechanistic one, and it's to ensure the best possible government. So what is your opinion on those two common ideas about voting, and do you have a different conception of the purpose of voting?
Yeah. A lot of what I said in the talk went more with the second conception you were talking about how can we ensure that the outcomes of elections will be good ones, which is really what the founding fathers were struggling with as they were writing the Constitution. It was what Adams was worried about. If we let lots of people who don't have property vote, maybe they'll get corrupted by other rich people offering money to get them to vote, whereas if we only let rich people vote, then they won't be corruptible. I'm not sure why he was optimistic about that. So he was definitely thinking you'll get better electoral outcomes if you exclude people who are corruptible or he had a pretty low opinion of women's intelligence and children's intelligence. So he was just trying to ensure better outcomes. And similarly, this talk about the conversation jury theorem is talking about getting good outcomes by having a large detector where each of the independent readings that you're getting are all correlated with the right outcome. But I don't mean to exclude. I think there's, as you said, the first thing you were saying where there's a way in which, getting to vote, your vote almost never makes a difference to what the outcome is going to be anyway. And if you are just doing sort of expected utility reasoning about, how much better will the world be if I vote than if I don't, it's almost always going to be better if you go and do something fun or spend some time with your kids or something like that. Your vote's not going to matter to what the outcome is. And yet, there might be some ways in which giving people a token voice in the process helps to respect their dignity or helps make them feel like they have a role in the system, that their voice is important, even if it actually, once you think about what the chances are of them making a difference, it actually isn't important at all. So you might think there's this other justification and we shouldn't worry so much about what the outcomes are going to be. I think some of these policy decisions do make a difference to what the outcome is going to be, because it's not just one or two votes that are going to change if you allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote, say, rather than just 18-year-olds. That probably would sway some outcomes. I'm open to the idea that this is another thing that voting does. To me, at least, I think that sort of reasoning would also suggest, hey, 16 and 17-year-olds are members of our society. Telling them they can't vote, their voice doesn't matter until they get older. Is that really respecting their dignity and stuff like that? It seems like this sort of reasoning might be a separate way of also saying that we ought to let young people vote too.
Having also lived through the time when they changed the voting from 21 to 7 to 18, the reason for that was at 18 you were allowed to serve in the military. And the thought was,
you should have a voice in what's going on. So are you saying if we were to lower the voting, doesn't it kind of follow that if we're going to lower the voting age below that, we should be drafting them into the military also?
I agree with you that people did tie this together, and that was a big part of the sort of propaganda that made lowering the voting age politically feasible, was saying if you're old enough to die for the country, you're old enough to have a voice in what the process is going to be. But, you know, there's other ways. Like the rallying cry for the revolution was taxation without representation, and it's not clear that everybody who's open to be taxed should be open to be drafted. And so, for me at least, I think the taxation without representation thing is the more gripping rallying cry.
We're going to say they're allowed to vote. If we're going to say they're allowed to vote, well, then they should have the responsibility of being drafted.
Yeah. I don't have worked out views about who should be drafted. I mean, currently we just draft men and not women, but we let women vote, if you push me on that issue, I'll say, no, we shouldn't have a sort of sexist draft that's drafting this one gender. There's lots of ways that women could contribute to their military. If we end up going to war, we should be drafting both men and women, I think. So maybe, but not because we let women vote. I don't think that it's that with the vote you also get this responsibility. So I just think it's part of everybody's civic duty to contribute to certain now. Should we be drafting 16-year-olds? I don't think so. I think it's better to keep them in high school a couple more years. Maybe if we start losing an important war, then maybe I'd start considering drafting 16-year-olds. But, you know, I feel like there are lots of ways where, you know, we just shouldn't have kids be fighting. And even though maybe we should be asking their opinion because they have an interest in the political process, we shouldn't be making them fight. But that's, I guess, my
question. Question here.
Dr. Fisher, I couldn't decide whether you were being facetious or not about giving children the right to vote.
I
was 17, I thought I knew everything. I took history of government, and I was top of my class. But I was a sophomore in wise school. I didn't know a thing about politics. The questions I have, I think that you need to address two issues. One is physiology. The adult brain was not fully developed until the mid-20s, especially the frontal lobes. And that has a lot to do with judgment, consequences, that sort of thing. So 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 21-year-olds may not have this. Number two, the issue of psychology. People don't vote as individuals. Yes, they voted into the booth alone, but they're influenced sociologically and by groups. And especially youngsters are particularly, teenagers are particularly influenced by their peers. That's why they riot and do bad things. So I think we should talk about those
changes. Good. And I'll even take what you're saying and put more words in your mouth, because it's a good criticism to make. I talk about the Condorcet jury theorem, which is a mathematical theorem, but one of the assumptions in the theorem is that the jurors are independent of each other. If you don't have statistical independence between the jurors' vote, then the theorem won't apply. And so as you're pointing out, that people voting, they aren't completely statistically independent of each other. They're often moved by the same news stories and the same talking heads and stuff like that to vote. And so we don't really have 100 million independent readings of who's the best president. Instead, we have lots of them that are statistically related with each other, strongly correlated with each other. So that means that the jury theorem, at least Condorcet's version of it, isn't going to apply. It gets more complicated once you take into account, there may be statistical correlations between the different voters. Similar results will still apply with weaker assumptions, but you might worry that there's enough correlation between the different voters that's going to keep any sort of result of this sort from applying. So I think those are great worries to have here, and if our thought is we want to set up a detector that is going to be correlated with the right outcome, then you might think, there are various ways that we ought to modify this system to help ensure independence between the different voters. So yeah, really sensitive to those sorts of worries. Which was your second point. Remind me of the first point you wanted to go
up to.
Oh yeah. You know, it sounds like maybe you're thinking that it was a mistake to lower the voting age to 18, that maybe we should have increased it even higher, having this sort of ideal voter picture and saying it's only people who have mature brains who should be allowed to vote. I feel like it's hard to put this, but we went back to that slide, which I suppose I could do, where we had all the 85-plus-year-olds. There's also lots of evidence about declining in faculties, and so if that was the reason you were using to say, hey, we shouldn't even let 18-year-olds vote, we should set it at 25, then you should stop voting after a particular, no offense intended to be from Serum, but once you reach a particular age, statistically, you're less sharp than a 24-year-old is, and so if we aren't going to let 24-year-olds vote, we probably shouldn't let 70-year-olds vote either. And so, for me at least, that feels too restrictive. I want a lot of people who, to have, you know, you can see I was even leaning towards the direction of letting all kinds of kids vote. I think we should be broadening the process. All these people who are taxed and have an interest in what the outcomes are going to be, I think they should have a voice in the process. So I'm happy letting the people whose brains aren't quite as mature as a 25-year-old's brain, happy to let them vote. And I'm also happy to let people continue voting even as their faculties are starting to decline in old age. So I wouldn't want this restrictions that you're suggesting, though I think that the sort of Federalist conception of having this really ideal well-informed voter could justify moves in the direction that you're suggesting.
So I had a very good. I had a question, and I'm not sure if I have my facts right. It seems like that I don't know if this is state-driven or federal-driven, but I have a problem with convicted felons who have paid their debts to society being precluded from voting. Because I have a real concern, but I was not sure if that was federally driven or state driven, but I just want to get your is it state? Okay.
I think it's state driven. I don't think the Constitution
the
Constitution leaves to state legislatures lots of these decisions about how exactly elections will go. And I think especially given that our criminal justice system is flawed in lots of other ways, that black people are much more likely to face prison sentences and to face felony convictions rather than misdemeanor convictions than white people are, that this is just a way that, you know, it's the new Jim Crow, it's a systematic disenfranchisement of black people. And I totally agree with you that it's wrong. And, you know, Florida, for example, finally has moved away from this, and thank goodness. They were too late to do it, they should have done it a lot sooner.
Texas has too, by the way.
Good. I lived here for 10 years now, but I actually am not up on Texas law in this issue yet.
I've not heard this argument being bandied about very much, which must mean that since nobody buys into your original, you know, reasons people can't vote, why not? I mean, it seemed perfectly reasonable, and yet if we took a poll in this room, we probably wouldn't find many people that want to let a 10-year-old vote. Why not?
I'm not sure.
What are the arguments against it these days?
I've tried to give the sorts of arguments. I think a lot of people think, no, you just need to be a certain level of intelligence and a certain level of maturity to be allowed to vote. And so that's, I think, the sort of rationales that people will give, which is not too different from those New Hampshire guys that I had it before. Now, there might be other sort of psychological explanations, that it's a lot like, sort of hazing in various organizations, like colleges and universities. There are Greek organizations where you get hazed by the new members of the fraternity, get hazed by the older members of the fraternity, and after they've gone through it, they say, well, now I've done my time, the next generation has to go through what I went through. And so it's a similar sort of thing. I had to wait until I was of age before I got to vote. I'm not going to extend rights to these other people that I didn't get to have. So there might be that sort of psychological explanation that if I didn't get to have it, they aren't going to get to have it. But I don't know. It might just be, I would like it if it changed. It seems to me that it ought to change, that this ought to get discussed and it ought to be extended. And there are some jurisdictions that do allow younger people to vote, and some countries that allow younger people to vote. But to me, this is a change that ought to happen. That it's a sort of mass disenfranchisement that should be happening.
Robert Epstein, who was a Democrat and voted for Hillary Clinton, is an expert in the field of how influence its votes. And he said that if we don't do something about it, big tech is going to be able to influence as many as 15 million votes. Now, you would probably agree with how they vote. But what are your thoughts on big tech? Basically, the people who run big tech are multiplying their vote by millions by influencing the way people do searches on the internet, you know, blocking certain terms and making certain things show up. So what's your feeling about that?
I think there is potential for influence happening that's somehow or other tech-driven. I don't buy into conspiracy theories that say, for example, Google's been trying to influence election outcomes by, you know, prioritizing some search results over others. But I do think that there is lots of evidence of various campaigns, for example, to get Facebook feeds to end up having different news stories or fake news stories in them, and you know, part of the evidence about Russian meddling in the last election is this sort of program that they were having. And definitely, the more people are getting their news and other things that are going to affect their votes from these sorts of tech-driven processes that easily could be exploited by somebody who has a sense of how they work and a sense of how to get viral stories into the process that can mislead people. Yeah, there is a risk of that. I think it's even a greater risk than it was when we got most of our news from a few media outlets who were much more responsible about figuring out which stories they were going to publish than a lot of current stuff is. So yeah, there are worries. I'm not sure what exactly the best solutions are. I think it would be nice if some sort of system could arise where Facebook stories could have some sort of independent commission verifying that the news stories are legit, and have some sort of sticker that goes on there, and have users of Facebook have some sort of setting that they could use that will screen out any stories that haven't been approved as legit by this independent organization. I think that would be an improvement over the current system. I think you might worry about, well, would this independent organization really give us the right answers, or would it just be handing more power to somebody that you don't trust? There are lots of great issues here, and I don't have answers to all of them, but yeah, there's lots of potentials for bad outcomes to arise, but you know, there always have been, and there probably always will be.
Okay, I tend to operate the mic badly. I'm really interested in your idea of a proficiency test to be allowed to vote, so that the, what's the sign say, the morons aren't allowed to vote. You gave examples when you talk of bad, trivial questions that were used to exclude people from voting. What, in your mind, would be examples of good questions to have on, you know, the civics test in sorting out, you know, informed voters from not so informed voters?
Good. Yeah, that's a good question. And I said I was officially neutral as to which of these two, whether we should start at the top left or the bottom left of the flowchart. Honestly, I think I'd lean more towards the bottom one, that, you know, widen the franchise as much as we can sort of account. If you got me to say, okay, let's be serious about this ideal voter conception and let's try to come up with the analog of a driving test for voting. If we were to do that, what should the questions be? I think things about, you know, what is our current spending, and have some sense of how much we spend on different things, that's something that's a pretty objective matter of fact. All parties can agree on it, and the people who think that we spend 10% of our budget on public broadcasting, you know, they don't have, you know, a good sense of what's going on here. Now, other things, what's the scientific consensus on climate change? I think that might be a good thing to ask the voters about, but I recognize that lots of folks would disagree, and this is the sort of thing that some people would be opposed to, and you know, I think if you were ever enacting something like this, you'd want to have it as bland and uncontroversial as you could in the way that, you know, the driving test is pretty bland and uncontroversial, and there isn't a deep partisan divide about what the questions ought to be on that. So I think if you're trying to enact something like this, that's the direction you definitely need to go. Is that still the best way to go? I think it might be better if we did have the climate change question on the test. That would probably lead to better outcomes than we would get without it on the test. But
I'm just trying to think of what kind of objective, nonpartisan questions could be on such a test.
And did the ones about saying, well, what percentage of our budget do we spend on military, what percent do we spend on welfare, that sort of thing, that seems like you can get pretty wide agreement on this, and also pretty wide agreement that this matters to decisions we're going to make. How much we are spending on things, it does make a difference to these decisions. So I think that sort of question is one that would be a plausible one to include. I'm not sure what other ones.
Question over here.
You mentioned the disenfranchisement of felons being equivalent to New Jim Crow. I guess I would ask, if we were to propose a sort of civics questionnaire for voting, might we consider who is going to be passing the test at a higher rate? We know that males on both the right and left, you mentioned the Daily Show, Daily Show viewership is primarily male. Males tend to be much more engaged with politics, particularly on an abstract level. And frankly, European Americans vote at much higher rates than other groups, tend to be much more civically engaged. So if we have a civics questionnaire and test, isn't that just kind of a new Jim Crow? In other words, who's going to be, how is that going to change the demographics of the voting base?
I share the concern about this, though I guess I go back to the analogy to the driving test, that it doesn't feel like we made driving be a whites-only thing by having a test that people need to take before they drive. It may be that the driving test is a little bit racially discriminatory, that if we didn't have a driving test, then maybe there would be more black people who would be allowed to drive by no longer needing to take a test than white people would be aided by it. But I guess I feel like in the case of driving, this isn't a deep, pressing issue, that I feel like we've managed to come up with a driving test system that doesn't have really deep racial problems in it. And I would hope that if we ever did try to go this sort of top route in this diagram, that we could do the same with a sort of civic literacy test or voting test. You may be right that the upshot of this would be that some demographic groups are either less likely to bother taking the test, less likely to bother studying for the test, and less likely to pass the test. And so definitely having this sort of thing, especially if it's a screening out the morons sort of approach, if all it is another way of locking in so kids who really want to vote can take the test and then be allowed to vote, my guess is that's not going to sway too many election outcomes because it's just not going to be that many kids. And as long as the test is easy enough that anybody who really wants to start voting will be able to study and pass it the way that the driving test is, then it wouldn't end up doing too much difference. But yeah, I share a lot of these concerns. I guess I'll again put more of my cards on the table and say I tend to lean a lot more in this direction, so I haven't thought through a whole lot of the best way of doing this because I don't think it's really the right way to go. So going back to the question over here about how much of it was my tongue in my cheek when I gave the talk, I was sincere about the thought that at least smart kids should be allowed to vote, that you get to that result whichever path you take. So it's, to me, that this one's really strongly supported. Among the other ones, I guess I'm more inclined to extend the vote to young kids than I am to try to figure out ways to exclude ill-informed adults from voting. That's not really the direction I think.
Question over here, Dr.
I guess on that note, looking at the evidence from history and current political systems around the world, would there be evidence that you would point to say that there is anything negative against inclusionary policy that would just simply allow more people and as a whole become better because of it? Is there any negative examples that you could point to that would say the more people, the better?
So, negative examples that have been argued against it?
Yeah, it's globally or in historical precedents as to being negative to include more people.
Yeah. I guess I should have been, what is it that Dr. McCoy says, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not an engineer. I'm a philosopher, not a historian. So I'm good at doing stuff in my armchair, but I can't actually tell you a whole lot about world history. Certainly, our history has been in the direction of increasing the franchise. I think overall that's been a really good thing. That's always been a step in the morally right direction, despite increasing it. And to me, this is one of the next directions we need to increase it. The Fallon's voting is another direction that is really morally pressing to increase it. Are there examples where having increased who's allowed to vote led to demonstrably bad outcomes? I'm not sure about that. Trump got elected in 2016, so you might think that there's an example that you could work with, but I'm not sure that I would blame it on any sort of extension.
As a population, it would be.
Say again?
As a total number, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. The total number of people who would have voted one way or the other.
Yes, yeah. I'm not sure that we should blame this on any sort of extension of... And I'm not sure. I can't think of a good example where we can say, hey, voting rights, I guess maybe if you were looking for examples like this, probably I'd look at women voting as because there's strong differences in women's preferences on lots of issues from men's preferences on lots of issues. And there are lots of elections that had women been disallowed from voting, the outcome would have been different than women. I think usually, in my view, the outcome's better because women were allowed to vote than it would have been had the women's votes not been counted. But if somebody had the opposite political leaning for mine, they might say, oh, there are lots of cases where these outcomes got worse because all these women were allowed to vote. And so they might think of these as examples. Where you're thinking of, whereas for me, maybe if men were disallowed from voting, we'd get the even better outcome.
Okay, two more questions.
Suppose it's a history. The Romans were pretty conservative in a lot of their voters. The way they set up their republic had to be in your 30s. You had to be married before you could run for office, etc. Very stable society, for the most part, society lost. On the other hand, Greece, with their Athens with their open democracy, mass democracy, a lot of problems. It tended to demagoguery. They would get these 21-year-olds. Of course, they were all male and free and Greek, but still, it was. The franchise was generalized. If a general lost a battle or a war, they killed him. And of course they put Socrates to death too. So Plato and Aristotle didn't like democracy. They didn't trust democracy. Democracy can run into dictatorship if they're dominant.
Yep. Definitely a lot of the concerns you're mentioning there, that's what was motivating the Federalist Society of this old debate between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. The Federalists were really worried. They didn't want a democracy. They wanted basically an aristocracy of the propertied white men to be making the decisions. It was only pretty reluctantly that they opened it up as far as they did. That sort of reasoning, to me at least, there are lots of ways that you can protect minority rights without needing to hand over the reins to just a few people. So my preference is to have a very wide franchise together with a strong Bill of Rights and a strong court system that will protect minority rights and will keep minorities from being trampled by whatever the majority is. That's my preferred way of solving these problems rather than just giving the right to vote to relatively few people the way the Romans did, that basically just gives them the ability to trample the rights of everybody else.
Okay, last question.
Yeah, I appreciate the last questionnaire. I was also going to bring up Aristotle. He had this theory about the cycle of governments that the grandfathers certainly believed in. You know, they had democracy, which led to the monarchy, which was overthrown by aristocracy, and I think there was one more process in that, but ultimately the aristocracy and franchise increased, it led to democracy, and the democracy decayed. And the founding fathers, and so this theory of history has kind of been rediscovered by many Western scholars throughout time, including Spengler, even social theorists, biologists like Woodley, Michael Woodley, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm going off the tangent here. But I'll get back to my point, which is that you know, the founding fathers definitely saw the increase of the enfranchisement as kind of the democracy itself was a sphere. So originally we had this party called the Democratic Republicans, and they were branded Democratic Republicans because democracy was an insult. So you know, we see toward the end of the empire, toward the end of the Greek city-states, towards the end of the Roman era, there's this corresponding thing that happens, which is that the vote gets extended to more and more people. And, you know, this is what the founding fathers believed, basically, that essentially, you know, you would have increased democracy, more and more people able to vote. That would eventually lead to dictatorship. Yeah, you would have this cycle continue. And I guess I'm just wondering, what's your opinion? Do you believe in that there is this cycle of history that the founding fathers believed in? Do you think that you have maybe more of a Whig notion of history or future progress? What's your opinion on that particular theory of history, I guess, as laid out by everyone?
Yeah, I guess the first thing I'll say is I don't have well worked out views about this stuff. I'm pretty skeptical of predictions of saying it's always going to follow this sort of cycle. You know, part of this is, you know, a lot is going to depend on what sorts of checks and balances are built into the system and what sorts of inertia are built in that might keep things from rapidly changing to having a broad franchise suddenly elect themselves a dictator and give away all their rights. You know, definitely this is stuff to be worried about, and you want to have a strong system in place that will prevent that sort of thing from happening. But I don't think that broadening the right to vote inevitably is going to lead to that sort of bad stuff from happening. And so I'd rather have checks and balances in place that'll keep that from happening while having a broad right to vote, rather than narrowing the right to vote in hopes of avoiding this from inevitably happening.
Okay, let's give another round of applause for that.